Medial, digital, genial. Behaltet den Überblick bei Medien macht Meinung, dem Podcast des Digital Journalism Fellowship der Hamburg Media School. Alles zu den digitalen Trends und Innovationen jetzt bei Medien macht Meinung.
Herzlich willkommen. Mein Name ist Anja Kollroß. Ich bin an der Hamburg Media School zuständig für das Digital Journalism Fellowship. Let's talk about money. Also jedenfalls ein bisschen. In dieser Folge möchte ich unter anderem über Geschäftsmodelle im Journalismus sprechen und schauen, ob sie nicht nur Krisen, sondern auch Corona-resistent sind. Dazu spreche ich mit dem US-Journalisten und Professor für Journalismus und Digitalexperte Jeff Jarvis. Zuallererst wollen wir aber über ein anderes Thema reden, das die USA und mittlerweile auch Europa fest im Griff hat. Nein, es ist nicht Corona. Jeff Jarvis ist mir jetzt aus seinem Haus in New Jersey zugeschaltet. Dieses Interview führen wir auf Englisch. Hello, Mr. Jarvis. Thank you for your time and for being my guest in today's podcast episode.
Vielen Dank. I'm happy to be here.
New York, the city where you're living, and the USA are still facing the corona pandemic, but lately the death of George Floyd, an unarmed black man who died in custody, and the riots it caused are dominating the news. Even in Europe, people are on the street demonstrating. How would you describe the situation in your country at the moment?
Nothing is new here. We're just discovering what has been reality once again. This has been a nation built on racism and a systemic racism. And it unfortunately takes these huge events to make them apparent. And that's the fault of media, that we have not covered this adequately, that it takes COVID to come along to show how communities are affected. They're dying more because they're essential workers, because they're living in more crowded spaces, because their healthcare is worse as a rule, and their healthcare in hospitals is worse now. And so the fundamental systemic racism that is exposed by COVID was then met with the murder by police again of a man whose only crime was being black. And so it took a 17-year-old, very brave young woman who shot the video and put it up on Facebook, on social media, so that we could all see what was happening. And this has clearly been going on for a very long time. It is thanks to the internet and social media and people's phones and people's courage that we're finally able to see it and understand it better. And so I think what we're seeing is finally an appropriate reaction to what has been happening for a very long time.
You mentioned social media. When I think about media in the US, the controversial TV channel Fox News comes to my mind. What do you think? What role do the media play in the case of George Floyd and these worldwide protests we are having by now?
I think they play many roles. The fact that it took social media to expose the everyday peril of being black in America means that mainstream media, mass media, had failed at this job. And we failed because too many newsrooms were run by people who look like me, old white men. And our newsrooms were not represented. I've been seeing stories lately of editors rejecting stories about communities because they weren't big enough for mass media. And so we didn't understand. And what social media enabled was for people who've always had voices to finally be heard. The hashtag Black Lives Matter is a platform for organization. More to the point, the hashtag Living While Black was very educational for me. To see white people calling the police on black people, perhaps with a death sentence, for such activities as shopping or walking or bird watching, that was possible in social media. So the first failure, I think, is one of mainstream mass media not representing, not understanding, not covering the concerns of these communities. Then we have another failure on top of that, which you raise, which is the most dangerous influence on democracy in the English-speaking world, namely Rupert Murdoch. And Fox News is a propaganda channel that has stoked hatred and fear, basically among old white men. What we're really seeing in America right now is the last stand of the old white man. And I say that again as an old white man myself. What we're seeing is anger, fear of not knowing what the future is going to hold, for people who used to be in the majority. By the year 2050, whites will not be in the majority in America. And they fear that because they recognize, many of them, that they have their position and privilege thanks to the color of their skin, not thanks to what they can do. It's about who they are, not what they do. And that's the reality that we have. And it was stoked by Rupert Murdoch and Fox News. And so I think that they bear some responsibility with talk radio for the amplification of that fear today. But we shouldn't put it all on them. We should also take blame ourselves in mainstream media.
So you're saying also journalism has a problem with racism?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And journalism schools. I don't hold us apart from that. We all have to understand better. And we need help to do that. It is not the job of people of color to teach me. It's my job to research. But researchers also have teachers. And so I think that we should have done a better job of bringing in facilitation into our companies of all sorts and institutions of all sorts to set goals for us about how to have difficult conversations, how to understand better. I went through an experience not long ago at a foundation where they brought in a facilitator because the foundation frankly had problems with racism. And I found it very valuable because I didn't have the tools, I didn't have the structure, I learned a lot. Now that foundation frankly treated it rather as a sham and I left the foundation because of this. But I learned a lot in that process, right? I learned that I couldn't do this all by myself. I couldn't rely on people of color to teach me. I had to, it's just like going to school. I had to learn more, and I have a lot more yet to learn.
Another main problem, not only for the USA, but also for the whole world, is the coronavirus. When we are only looking on what impact it has on today's journalism, what would you say, what are the main changes it caused so far?
So I've learned a lot in the pandemic. I, as it started, I looked and said, the battlefield has changed here. Claire Wardle, the founder of First Draft, who is brilliant at understanding and fighting disinformation, said that the nature of the errors she was finding was changing. It was less disinformation, more misinformation. It was often innocent. It was people who didn't know what they were talking about. Well, that's an enemy we should know how to fight. That's ignorance. And the best weapon against that enemy is expertise. So I started a COVID Twitter list. If you go to bit.ly/COVID Twitter list, you'll find 600 epidemiologists, virologists, geneticists, biologists, frontline doctors, public health researchers, and so on, and a few journalists in there with credentialed expertise in this area. And I've been fascinated watching how they have adapted to a new open information ecosystem and used it positively. So we know that there are lots of scientific papers coming out quickly now, more than 10,000 around COVID, on so-called preprint servers. That is to say, they were not peer-reviewed and printed, which means the information is coming out much faster. And most of this information is terribly useful and good for scientists to be able to share it. But they needed systems to make this usable. So the first thing they needed was to make the information open to get these very expensive journals to no longer be the control point. Then they needed a way to organize it. Well, the preprint servers became part of that, and then there are services on top of that to find them by topic and so on. But then, very importantly, they needed to replicate the value of peer review. And so they're doing that on Twitter. Twitter is peer review at the speed of the internet. It is fascinating to watch. Then they needed to review the reviewers. Who among the scientists talking about these papers knows what they're talking about and who doesn't is an important part of this, by their credentials and by their actions and who respects them. And then finally, they had to be able to explain this all to the public. That is all happening right now in a matter of months before our eyes. I've interviewed a few of the doctors on my list. You can find the video at buzzmachine.com to ask them, how should we be covering COVID in journalism? What are we doing wrong? And the most important thing is for us to find relevant expertise. Right now, this morning on TV, there was much controversy about something that was misinterpreted that the World Health Organization had said. And the cable channel had on a spine surgeon to talk about virology and epidemiology. Wrong, right? You should, just because he has a doctor, and he's okay, he's not bad, but have on an expert. The experts are easy to find. There was a paper the New York Times wrote about, a controversial paper from Santa Clara, California, on serology, on antibody testing. And it was used by the Trumpists to say we should open up again. Well, within an hour of the paper, I saw on Twitter five or six very respected epidemiologists who sliced apart the paper respectfully, but with facts, piece by piece by piece. The New York Times didn't quote anyone but the author of the paper. That's wrong. The scientists tell me that when you write about a preprint, you should never just quote the author. You should go find three or four more experts. You should quote them. These are the lessons that I'm learning from the scientists about how journalism should operate. And the primary lesson is that we've got to be better in journalism at understanding how to cover science as a process. We tend to treat the latest word as the last word. We put up a story that Dr. So-and-so did a paper saying, wine will save you. And the next week we do a paper that says, wine will kill you. No, it's all a process, as is society, as is democracy. And I think we have a lot to learn from how scientists are using these new tools. Meanwhile, we in journalism are dismissing them because we're jealous of our role as gatekeeper being taken away.
You were talking about the content, but let's have a look on the money. What kind of business models are existing in the world of journalism, and how is Corona changing them?
So I wrote a post about a year and a half ago saying that our house was on fire, and the virus, the pandemic, threw gunpowder on that fire. So it sped up, I think, what was an inevitable path to destruction, unfortunately, for many companies that had not innovated sufficiently and had not updated themselves. And so I think we're going to see ashes. We're going to see things burn to the ground. And yes, that's unfortunate, but I also have hope for the sprouts that are going to grow from it. And whenever I talk about new models, and I'll list a few in a second, people in journalism scold me and say, it doesn't scale, it's not fast enough, it's not going to save us overnight. Well, we are constantly in search of messiahs, and all the messiahs we have found so far have been false. We were not saved by tablets or paywalls or programmatic advertising or any of these things. Instead, what we're seeing is new small efforts that rise up that will, I think, in a very messy fashion, start to demonstrate new things that work. I wrote a post about a week ago talking about a few of these. Just for example, there's a company in Canada called Village Media that starts local news sites, pretty classic local news sites with local information. They don't waste time rewriting press releases. They put them up from the town. They label them. They spend their time on reporting. They have new ad models, but they're still advertising models. They're getting contributions from their readers as well, and they're profitable. It's a way to build for a town of 50,000 to 150,000 a decent business. I talked to a company in Norway called InnoCode that is looking at transparency as a service. Towns are better off if they're transparent, so there's business in helping them be transparent and even being paid by the town for that, and they've worked on that. Then I talked to a paper in Germany, in Minden, which I was amused. I saw a story in Die Zeit that they were delivering beer. Well, that's a story we have to love in journalism, and we have to, of course, think of it as a German stereotype, so we had to look at it. So I had an email with the publisher of the paper, and he said that they'd already started something like this before. They have a fulfillment operation and delivering papers and advertising and all kinds of things. So when the coronavirus hit, they decided to start delivering things for the local merchants, beer and shoes and office supplies. Now, is this going to make them rich? No. But it shows that they care about the local businesses. They care about the local business community. They wanted to try to help. And then I was talking about this with our news innovation and leadership class run by Anita Zelina, formerly of Stern and Der Standard and the NZZ. And she said, oh, yes, Jeff, at Der Standard, they bought, when she was there, a bread company that delivered a croissant and rolls to you with your news every morning. Now, these are not models that are going to save journalism overnight, but they are innovative models that are going to be little sprouts that rise from the ashes. I'm quite fond of Spaceship Media, which convenes communities in a conversation. I'm a fan of Outlier Media in Detroit, which answers people's questions. I'm a fan of City Bureau in Chicago that trains people to cover meetings and be collaborators in journalism. I'm a fan of Texas Tribune and The City in New York, which are newfangled non-for-profit efforts. There are a lot of efforts with models going out there, but I emphasize this is going to take time.
What is your opinion on financial support by foundations or even by the state?
Once again, we keep looking for messiahs. We went through, and again, tablets didn't save us, programmatic ads didn't save us, paywalls didn't save us, neither will manna from heaven, whether from foundations or government. There is a role for one, charitable support from readers, right? The Guardian is now profitable because more than a million people have chosen to give them money to support their journalism. El Diario in Madrid is supported in great measure by contributions from their readers. So charity has its role. Foundations have a role too. If you look at Texas Tribune in Austin, Texas, and an outlet that we're involved with called The City in New York, they've raised money from foundations for not-for-profit journalism. That has a role in the ecosystem, but there is not nearly enough philanthropy in the world to cover the journalism that we need. Even in the United States, where we have a culture of philanthropy, in Europe, there isn't as much of a culture of philanthropy, and there's not enough money there. It'll supplement. It will not provide enough journalism. Then we move to government. I am very frightened of government support in and thus in, investment and involvement and interference in journalism or speech. Now, yes, you have ZDF. And the UK has the BBC. And those were always the answers to me when I said there's a problem here. And I said, my answer is two words, Donald Trump. Well, then to my BBC backing friends, the answer is two words, Boris Johnson, who's trying to interfere with the BBC. We should be separate from government. We should be independent of government. We should not be dependent on government. And now that is an American view, given our circumstance. And so I'm not suggesting that you should turn off ZDF tomorrow. It's a valuable asset. It works. It's good. God bless that you have that. But you also need a healthy, independent, commercially viable media ecosystem. And so we've got to concentrate not on some kind of rescue from on high. We've got to concentrate on making that future for our business.
U.S. news are often ahead of us when it comes to trends, information, developments. How is the situation for publishers in your country at the moment? And what should we maybe be aware of in Europe?
It's very bad in the U.S. and it's obviously gotten worse from COVID, but it was already going bad. As a friend of mine pointed out recently, basically every major newspaper chain in the U.S. is now controlled, if not owned, by hedge funds. And we know what hedge funds do. They do what they do. It's their business to buy distressed debt, to sell off assets, to take cash flow, and they're not going to invest in the future. It's just not what they do. Other chains are owned by families, but those families, God bless them, are impatient. They've been patient for a long time. They've lost that. They really don't have the guts to invest in innovation much. So that's the state of the newspaper business. You have companies like Gannett and Gatehouse merged before Corona, and their stock has plummeted. McClatchy, which has a very smart CEO, is in bankruptcy because of its pension obligations, but it's still now going to be controlled by a hedge fund. Tribune is a disaster controlled by a hedge fund, and on and on and on. So we know what's going to happen there. They're not going to invest. And we have to invest in and experiment in and thus risk and thus fail oftentimes in how we come up with new sprouts and new models. The magazine business, it's not enviable either. Local television had been very strong, but it's getting weaker. So the media structure in the U.S. is bad. For years, I've seen, you know, from your organization, people have come over to the U.S. and said, tell us what the future is. Tell us what you're doing that's right. Tell us what we should learn. And I always tell them, no, we're just dying faster than you are. So what you should do is see us as a, as we say off English, the canary in the coal mine. And, understand that you might have a little more time in Europe, but you've got to use that time wisely to become sustainable digitally.
You mentioned The Guardian in the UK, where people donating money to the paper. Should we also invest more in people's trust, maybe, so they will start supporting more the media?
Yes, but I fear that journalists are a very entitled breed. We think that we can just tell people journalism costs a lot of money. You really should pay us. Well, people have their own budgets and their own things that they need to spend money on, especially now when a fifth of America is unemployed. It becomes pretty cheeky to say, this is the time when you should be giving us your money when you don't have a job. So again, it's a messiah that is going to turn out to be false. Now, That's not to say that we shouldn't give the people the opportunity to give us money. I think we should. I think it's working. The Guardian works. Stat, which is a wonderful medical site in Boston, is opening the opportunity to contribute money, and I've contributed money. McClatchy has done the same thing, and I've done that. And Advance, my old employer here in New York, in New Jersey, has done that. So we ought to ask for money. But the idea that if we make people trust us, they will give us money sounds like entitlement to me. And indeed, when I say that we've got to rebuild trust in journalism and news, there are those in America who will say, no, you're wrong. You think that everyone used to trust the news, and many communities did not. African-American communities, Latinx communities, LGBTQ communities, immigrant communities were not represented by and did not trust us. Conservative communities don't trust us. So it's not going to be some easy task to say that we can make people trust us again. This is why we started a new program, a degree 5 years ago at our school at Newmark in social journalism, where we believe we have to turn the fundamental relationship of journalism around and start not with content, but with communities and their conversations. I redefined journalism because I have tenure. I can be obnoxious and do things like that. So my working definition of journalism now is to convene communities into respectful, informed, and productive conversation. Informed is still in there in the middle of the sandwich, but respectful is important. We've got to understand how to help people listen to each other. We've got to listen to them. Productive. We've got to be able to try to get things done with movements like solutions journalism and constructive journalism. And so our students start not with ideas for stories and content and ways to get people to read us. They start by finding communities that are self-defined, not bullshit like millennials, but communities that define themselves in a certain way. With shared needs. And then our students observe and listen to them and empathize with them and reflect them and then decide what kind of journalism we might bring to them to help them in their lives with their own goals. And then they do unusual things. Our class that graduated in December, just brilliant. I was caught by the students ugly crying, as they said, watching them. One student is a recovering addict herself, and so her solution was to bring addicts databases of information for them. Another student was helping the families of who lost members to addiction, and she brought them together for events for shared empathy. Another was trying to work with women who've been abused, and she used the theater of the oppressed so they could tell their own stories, and on and on and on. This is not about producing a product out of a factory that we call content to get people's attention for our business model. This is about journalism as a service to try to serve communities better, and we can only do that if we start by listening to them. The primary skill that I have seen necessary and I have learned in teaching both entrepreneurial journalism and social journalism is listening.
When your students listening to the communities, what is their feedback so far?
It's not feedback to what we do, it's listening to what their needs are. So when we have the new students come in the fall, we have a panel of community leaders from the South Bronx, a poor area where we happen to own two newspapers. Well, they have been newspapers. They're going to be primarily mobile now. And the students listen to them first and find out what their needs are before they imagine what the journalism is. We had a case, an anecdote at the school where one student was looking at both of our degree programs, and she heard our brainwashing in social journalism, and then she went to the other program where it's very, very common, was told, well, come up with a beat memo and five story ideas that people want to read. And the student said, no, I can't do that. I don't know this community yet. I don't know what their needs are yet. I would bring my own prejudices and biases here. No. And she came into our program. And so I think that I listen often to the words of James Carey, the late Columbia University professor, who says that society is a conversation. Journalism is not informed by the conversation. I'm sorry, journalism does not inform the conversation. It is informed by the conversation. Journalism starts with the conversation. We have to understand how to make that conversation better, as companies like Spaceship Media do.
You wrote, "Our house was already on fire. The coronavirus just threw gunpowder on the flames." When we are talking about the corona pandemic and journalism, do we also have to talk about chances and not only challenges?
I think so. I think that after the American presidential election 2016, we all concentrated on disinformation and manipulation and bots and Russians and all the bad stuff. And we thought we could pound out the bad stuff as we went, which was a fool's errand, I think. Come the coronavirus, as I said, I started this COVID Twitter list, and I saw that our primary job was not to eliminate disinformation, but instead to amplify expertise. And I think when it comes to science, we have a better opportunity than with politics, that most people want answers. They want information. They want to understand how to be responsible. They have grandparents, they have children, they have jobs. They need to figure out what the hell to do. And they can turn to us. Now, when they turn to us, it is our job to go to the experts. It always has been our job. It's what we've always done. But we've seen that there are new and more effective ways to do that. Let's look at television for a second. Right? So television, you had to be on their Booker's list to come in. You probably had to have a bunch of job titles to do that. You had to have a nice suit. And you had to be able to get into a studio to do that. Well, what's happened? Of course, you and I are now speaking by audio and by Zoom. And now so is television. Which means that television can now go to anyone who's connected in the entire world. They're doing a slightly better job of that. They're bringing in some new voices that they didn't listen to before. Not new voices, voices that were there that just weren't heard. But then those people become the standard people they go back to again and again and again. They haven't taken advantage. So television has a huge opportunity now to reach voices and communities and expertise that wasn't heard before they can amplify. The rest of journalism has the opportunity to find experts who were hard to find before. I've got a list of 600 of them around COVID. They're there. They want to help us get the story right for the public. They want to explain things to us. They want to answer our questions. That's possible because of the internet, and it's possible because of COVID. We can find them very easily. They have taken advantage of social media. So I think that are there still ignorant fools who choose ignorance? Yes. I remember a video the first time people tried to go back to church in the United States, and a reporter asked the woman, "Why are you going back?" And she said, "I'm safe. I'm bathed in the blood of Jesus." And we saw churches 2 weeks later close again because people were getting sick there and dying there, which is a horrendous sin in my view. Are we going to teach that woman a different way to look at the world in a few tweets or a few news stories? No. But I do believe there's a vast majority of people who care about information, and that's our business.
Coming to the last question, since we are almost at the end of this episode, you're teaching the next generation of journalists. What are you learning from your students these days?
Oh, I learn from my students every day and constantly. I learn from their innovation. I tell them that I am too old to see how this turns out. It's only the year 1475 in Gutenberg time. They may be too old too, but they are the innovators. So when I watched their presentations in social journalism last December at their graduation, I was moved by seeing them take on these ideas, make them their own, add to them immensely, and create a vision for a new journalism. But very importantly, the most important thing I think I've learned at teaching at Newmark in the almost 15 years I've been there is the value of the students' diverse lived experiences. That is the greatest, to put it in crude terms, that is the greatest asset our school has. And we need to do a better job of bringing that out. You know, I was talking to a bunch of educators from other schools, and I don't mean to put us above other schools. We've got a lot to learn at our school, believe me. But I was talking to another school some time ago, and the professors were saying, "Oh, these students, they come in, and yeah, they don't know how to write. They don't know how to speak. They don't know how to do this. They don't know how to do that." And I said, "They know things you don't know. They know how to communicate with each other in ways that we didn't imagine. You'd best listen to them first and respect their abilities first and understand their goals first. And then, yes, I hope we still have something to bring to them." But I tell our students every year in the fall, I get the opportunity to brainwash and hypnotize them all. And I say to them, it is up to you to reinvent journalism. Once again, I am too old. I'm the wrong person. I'm here because I want to help them do it. They should learn what we teach them. but then they should question everything we teach them. They should ask, how the hell did we get here? Why do we do it that way? What's the finances behind that? What's the economics behind that? What are we really trying to do? And how can we do that better? And I see my students do that. And I see them do it in great measure because they come from communities other than mine. I wrote a piece for the Irish Journal, the journal in Ireland last week, about what's going on in America. And I said it's the last stand of the old white men. And I say that as an old white man. And I was raised in this country in a time of the belief in a melting pot, in a colorblind country. And it took me a long time to see the racism of that. Because what they really said was that we'll be okay when you all start to act like us, the majority. Well, that's not the case. And I always need to do a better job of valuing the students' experience and starting by listening to them. And I, as you can tell, I talk a lot. I talk too much. So I still have much to learn from them. And primarily, as I teach them to listen, I have to learn better to listen myself.
Although our topics were really serious this time, I'm glad that we can end with a positive outlook for the future of journalism. Mr. Jarvis, many thanks for this interview.
And thank you.
Also ein positiver Ausblick, trotz der sehr ernsten Themen. Das war die aktuelle Folge von Medien macht Meinung, dem Podcast des Digital Journalism Fellowship der Hamburg Media School. Ich hoffe, wir hören uns auch beim nächsten Mal. Bis dahin, alles Gute!